Today on Wings.
What does it mean to parent, to give birth to shelter, life during a genocide?
The guest is Shireen Sekaly, editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Since its founding in 1971, JPS has been the English language academic journal of record on Palestinian affairs. Elizabeth Robinson interviewed Professor Sekaly in September 2024 about her fully documented and heartrending editor's note in the current quarterly edition.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Here now is host Elizabeth Robinson introducing Professor Sekaly for a program that first aired on campus community radio station KCSB at the University of California in Santa Barbara.
Shireen Sekaly is an historian of note. She is a professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She is the editor of a number of things, including the Journal of Palestine Studies. She has been co-editor with a historian of renown, Rashid Khalidi, and has recently become the sole editor and has written and is writing editorial notes for each journal to sort of serve as a guide for readers. And for those of us who are not readers of the journal, to know that we can find a lot of history there and a lot more than we're getting in our daily newspapers. With that, I want to say, Shireen Sekaly, thank you so much for being with me this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What I thought we would do is go straight to the piece that you've written for the Journal of Palestine Studies. That is listed as the editor's note, and which I think typifies for me your work around your thought and your activism of bringing people inside, humanizing history. I never can understand how people can find history boring. It's just usually a bad historian, maybe. But let's begin with the beginning of your editor's note, if you would.
Of course. 5 kilos of potatoes. Abed's three-year-old, Lour, begged her father to play their favorite game. He used to roll her up in a blanket and carry her high in the sky. Abed was the seller and Lour the vegetable. These days, his daughter's pleas filled Abed with dread, triggering images of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip gathering fragments of their loved ones. He looked on to the genocide from Jaffa, where structural racism, violence, and dispossession of Palestinians had only heightened since October. He weighed his options. Do we cling to our land or ensure our children's safety and leave? The dread grew deeper with the knowledge that parents in the Gaza Strip did not have this choice. The Israeli and U.S. genocide of Palestinians in Gaza has killed at least 16,500 children. 21,000 children are lost, detained, or buried in unmarked graves. 17,000 children are orphaned by or separated from their families. 4,000 children are missing under the rubble. Since October 2023, 20,000 Palestinian babies have been born into a world under active destruction. They have been sentenced to death in the womb. Since October, miscarriages have surged by 300%. Maternal and neonatal mortality has quadrupled. In every case of C-section reported to Doctors Without Borders, the baby has died. The newborns who come into a world of thirst and famine will drink less than a fraction of a cup of water and eat as little as 245 calories a day. They will suffer from diarrhea and vomiting. They might contract polio. They will be subject to Israeli snipers who have reiteratively cut down young life. What does it mean to parent, to give birth to shelter, life during a genocide?
That from your piece in the Journal of Palestine Studies. One of the most notable things about it, aside from the weight of the content, is the weight of the footnotes. This maybe 5,000 word essay has 100 footnotes, or almost 100 footnotes. And it speaks to your practice as an historian, but it also speaks to your reality as a Palestinian and to the denialism of your existence that we should address straight away. Why did you, I mean, like every sentence almost in the first parts has a footnote.
Yeah, I work with a wonderful editor who said to me, you know, these footnotes, these endnotes are, there's so many of them, maybe we can streamline some of them. And I said, no, it's very intentional that every sentence has a source, because for a number of reasons. The first reason is the reality of genocide and Nakba denialism, which is ubiquitous in this moment, that after 11 months of ceaseless murder, mass collective punishment, and ongoing, essentially, bombardment of what we can now characterize as a concentration camp where people are being starved and bombed at the same time, in the face of that denialism, and in the face of the ubiquitous attempts to silence us on every single level, the work here is evidentiary. It is drawing inspiration from something Edward Said wrote about in the late 1970s about a discipline of detail. What is a discipline of detail? And how can the work of detail empower us to continue the fight every day for Palestinian freedom and Palestinian liberation? More broadly speaking, I think that these editorial notes that I've worked on with Rashid since I started in 2020 were really centered around uplifting Palestinian voices. And here the plea is for all the folks who are really centering Palestine in beautiful ways and mobilizing it as a space of political imagination. This is a plea to really do the work of reading what Palestinians themselves are writing, how Palestinians themselves are testifying. And so part of what is happening here is a kind of layering of those voices and an invitation to explore and center those voices, to really do the work of mobilizing for Palestine by centering Palestinians. Lastly, I would say that part of this work for me is also a kind of feminist citational practices, a feminist citational practice that invites us all to think about authorship and writing as collaborative, that invites us all to think about how knowledge production is a space itself of collaborative, collective work. And this, I hope that these editor's notes really serve as a kind of roundup of all of the knowledge production that is happening in the face of what sometimes appears as a kind of imperative of single authorship. I think feminist citational practices are really crucial in times of genocide and in all times.
Well, I just have to make one aside here, which shouldn't be necessary, but most universities, colleges, high schools, etc., require you to work alone or tend to deny the efficacy of whatever you've done, if you've done it collectively. And it is such an impoverishing idea. And I think as feminist practice, it's extremely important to acknowledge that. I thank you.
Yeah, and I think all the media workers, yourself, and the program, understand that often silent work of editorship that really goes into helping craft words and craft knowledge. And it is a craft. It's not, you know, so I like to think of that craft as really centered around that kind of acknowledgement of what's brought us into the room, what's made that room possible.
As you speak, and as has been practiced here at the University of California campus by groups like Academics for Justice in Palestine, there's an insistence on bringing those voices forward and also preventing them from being buried once again. One of the things that I think of as you're speaking about this is how much excavation we always are doing in terms of anything beyond the normative mainstream media, academy, what have you, to say, no, that's not the whole story.
Yeah.
So I'm doubly appreciative of that and of your insistence of it when you deal with students, because I've seen that too. When other people can't talk to oppositional voices, you invite them in. So thank you. The denialism, however, begins right now by dating everything to October 7th. And as you're talking, I can remember the intifadas in the past when the IDF practice, the Israeli Defense Forces so-called practice, was to maim people. And this is not unique to Israel. Warfare often understands, or the makers of warfare, that a wounded colleague or soldier, whatever, demands the attention of several people. And so it's intentional. But I think it's easily seen right now in Gaza and increasingly on the West Bank. And it goes way back. So just to say, this is not about the last year. It's about decades. But with that, there are also particular practices that reiterate the lethality, the genocidal impulse here. And part of that is to look at women undergoing or attempting to undergo childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we can return to the article. You can comment otherwise, but also to return to the article.
Mm-hmm. On Wings, you are listening to a discussion between radio host Elizabeth Robinson of campus radio station KCSB at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a distinguished history professor there, Shireen Sekely, who is also affiliated with the Department of Feminist Studies. Sekely is the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. The spark for their discussion is the editor's note Sekely wrote for Volume 53 of the journal, published in August 2024.
Well, I want to say just a couple points on the Nakba denialism, and then I'll get into what I hope in each of these pieces to do. And this is, a practice that Rashida and I did together that I'm trying to get deeper into, which is really try to take these editors' notes into a space where we're seeing them from the perspective of people trying to survive on the ground. And as my friend and colleague Cecilia Mendez pointed out to me, that what I'm trying to do in this piece is accompany people as they suffer. Before we get to that, I'll just say three points about the Nakba denialism. As you point out, there's a long history of this. And one of the things that is so challenging in this moment for Palestinians and historians of Palestine is to see the multiple continuities of the last 100 years, right? Of to see how the kinds of propaganda and denialism is so part of a piece of a longer structure of denialism and of the Nakba itself in 1948, right? And I think here it's really important to think about, for all the listeners, our own complicity in that denialism, because it is everywhere. It is in the government, in the complicity of US, UK, German, French, so many governments that are arming this genocide and giving it impunity, particularly the United States and the international, on the international scale. It is in the media, in journals like The Atlantic that espouse, you know, viewpoints that it's possible to kill children legally. It's in the New York Times style guidelines that restrict the use of the terms genocide and ethnic cleansing when it comes to Palestinians. It's in people who argue, as they have on the pages of The New Yorker, that, you know, Arabs and Palestinians are somehow not rapable, right? This is an argument that, you know, weaponizes the rapes on October 7 as somehow grounds to justify genocide, while denying the systemic rape of Palestinian men and women that Israel is conducting. It is the fact that in the so-called, you know, House of the People, we see an attempt to bar the State Department from using international affairs budget to funds to even cite figures. We saw the spectacle of Netanyahu basically presenting himself as heroic and righteous in that House of the People in the United States for conducting a genocide. We saw it in the Democratic National Convention when, as Nour Arakat put it, a genocide of massive proportions was transformed into a hostage crisis. You know, really shameful. I think we as historians understand that it is much easier to take the right stand in retrospect, when the moral urgency of standing up has passed. And I think the moral urgency of standing up to Nakba denialism is very intense now. I'll end with a final point, and this is something that has really been so striking to me, is how is it that these Palestinians who are so bereft, and so bereft of any kind of military or international power, how are they the source of so much fear? And I think this is another pattern that we see historically, when the dispossessed are actually a source of such fear. And in each of these issues, each of these editor's notes, I've tried to highlight the plight of a specific Palestinian academic as they face attempts of silencing. In the first editor's note that I did on my own, it was the case of Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian. And in this piece, it's the case of Rabia Aghbari, who wrote a piece about the Nakba, in which he was trying to really highlight the Nakba as a legal category, which faced a whole infrastructure of silencing from the Harvard Law Review to the Columbia Law Review, an infrastructure that he was able in the end to, at least for now, overcome. So in the face of all of that, I think this is one of the challenges of what it means to be colonized, which is you have all of these forces that are so much larger than you, and the temptation is to center those forces and analyze them. But the responsibility is to center Palestinian life. It isn't only to narrate the destruction, but to center Palestinian life and its experience of that destruction. So with that, I will just read a short bit about Wesheha, who is a woman who gave birth in genocide that I tried to accompany. Wesheha's contractions started at 9 p.m. on October 29, 2023. She had fled her home a few weeks earlier. Her spouse was stuck in the United Arab Emirates. The anxiety and fear that pierced her exceeded the pain of the baby's imminent arrival. Like all pregnant women in Gaza, Wesheha had no access to running water, a clean toilet, ultrasounds, blood pressure cuffs, stethoscopes, or painkillers. She worried about her blood pressure, a leading cause of maternal death. She worried about her amniotic fluid. She worried about the baby's position. She worried about the baby's heartbeat. When the contractions started, Wesheha and her mother braved the shelling and managed to secure an ambulance. They made it to Al Awda Hospital in Nusayrat refugee camp. It was dilapidated, destroyed, and overcrowded. The maternity ward had become an urgent care unit. The flow of casualties was constant. The injured bled out onto the floor. Screams bounced off the walls. Within an hour, Wesheha gave birth to the tempo of Israeli shelling. Every 5 minutes, she hid the baby in her clothes, hoping to shield the newborn from shattered glass. Like most women who gave birth in a hospital, she was discharged within 3 hours of delivering. With no choice but to keep moving, Wesheha and her mother braved the streets again, this time with a newborn tucked in the folds of their exhaustion and despair. It took 3 hours to secure a car. And there I go on with how Wesheha actually was lucky in the context that she was in, because she had a natural birth, because the baby lived. And then I give a sense of, you know, really what it means to be a mother, to be an expecting mother in the midst of a genocide. I mean, I think about this all the time. What does it mean to carry life, you know, in this moment? And then to basically be left on your own to deal with the complications of childbirth.
Let me read a tiny bit, because please, it goes right to this. To parent in genocide is to exist in fragments between life and death. Every hour, Israel kills two women in the Gaza Strip. Every day, 37 children lose their mothers. Every pregnant woman lives in the interstices of anticipation and terror, giving birth amidst death. Every pregnant woman looks on to a landscape of miscarriage, stillbirth, premature births, and congenital abnormalities. They survive blood clots, multiple displacements, witnessing their children ravaged by shrapnel, disease, and hunger. They take recourse in all that is left for them to make bread, animal feed. I'm going to stop there and note that it is in the specificity and in the generality that you bring to this piece that the argument for Nakba denialism, or for whether or not this is a genocide, is just destroyed. You cannot be reasonable and call out the facts only that you want to hear.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead. Okay.
I just wanted to say that one of my concerns and fears is that in the kind of large numbers, that it's these stories that we lose. And I think I've tried really, you know, to think about the first editor's note I did on my own focused on the children, because this genocide has targeted children inordinately. And as Ghassan Abu Sitti has taught us, the surgeon, that this genocide has produced the largest cohort of children with amputees ever historically. And so I think, you know, this goes back to your point earlier about the maiming And, you know, I think of Jasbir Poor's book, The Right to Maim, that we began to see in the first Intifada, when at the time Yitzhak Rabin said, break their bones, right? And so this kind of, you know, I'm so haunted by the stories of these individuals. And I'm trying to really at least record those for the archive in the future.
May I read the last bit?
Please.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip birth, shelter, and imagine life in a new stage of the Nakba, existing in the interstices between past and future, debility and loss. Palestinian parents in the Gaza Strip wrest life from death, hope from despair, cohesion from fragments. Their grief is a portal through time and place. We follow their directive to, quote, leave the door to the tent ajar and put a dish of lentil soup on the floor. The kids could wake up from their graves hungry any time. And that's the end of it. But now I've just blanked on the author's name, on the poet's name.
His name is Musab Abu Toha, and you can follow him on Twitter.
Right.
And he does actually, this last quote was something he translated from a friend of his.
Shireen, let me let you have a last word, as you should. And just as a lead into that, it's stunning how many people that we've seen quoted, who are writing, who are in Gaza or elsewhere, who are no longer with us, who
Absolutely.
Have been part of the toll of all of this. But for you, last word.
I guess I would just say that the work ahead is to somehow balance the broader struggle with this specificity. And I think that is the work of detail that we all must really embark on. The detail, the labor of detail, the labor of collective, collaborative work, however painful and difficult that is, in order for us to imagine a free Palestine and a free life for all of us, because I think Palestine is a microcosm for so many things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you remind me of A.C. Venandan's novel. It's titled When Memory Dies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just unacceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't let it die.
Thank you so much, Shireen Sikkeli.
Thank you.
All of your work, but for this today too.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. It's an honor to be here with you.
That was Elizabeth Robinson's interview with Shireen Sikkeli, Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Santa Barbara and editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Sikkeli is also affiliated with the university's Department of Feminist Studies. The interview was conducted especially for Wings and was hosted at campus community radio station KCSB. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose recent events can be viewed through the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.